Okay, I think that's got everybody. Okay, so today we're going to be exploring. We take different themes with the Upasika days, and this is practice in a global context, and so it's sort of a big picture aspect of our practice. We had the initial topic that we had is something like do Buddhists get angry? Buddhist identity. Because I'm sure that there are people here who have been called out, and you get sort of upset at something, and somebody says, "I thought you were a Buddhist." The sense of Buddhist identity, and then cultural views and expectations of Buddhism, before the meal offering with the group that took the precepts, I was saying that works in. It can work in both ways in terms of a negative way or unskillful, but also it can be skillful. It can be something that we try to live up to, try to encourage ourselves with, try to lift the game a bit. So we'll have the opportunity to explore that today. I think one of the things for just kind of reflection, Buddhists, there is some kind of expectation or is some assumption, even if there isn't much knowledge of what a Buddhist is, really. I think it was one of the great examples was Ajahn Jyoti Paulo Father William were on a tudong together in northern Minnesota, hardly a hotbed of Buddhism, and Father William's quite a senior Catholic monk, and he's been here a couple times, and he was really interested in this whole idea of tudong. So he and Jyoti Paulo, when he heard what the Buddhist monks did, he really wanted to do it. And they ended up doing a tudong walk in northern Minnesota. That's where Father William's monastery is. But they're out in the countryside and the villages around walking. Father William, as a Catholic monk, could carry money, handle money, but one of the things that Ajahn Jyoti Paulo said was sort of leave it all behind, and then if somebody offers money, then you can make use of it. But we should start with no money. And that was, he said to Father William, as you can see him color fading. they'd been out on tudong for a couple of days, and uh, and uh, And somebody had given some money, and they'd gone on alms round. They didn't really have anything offered for food. So then Father William said, oh, we could use the money that was offered, and we could have lunch. So they went out for lunch. Ajahn Jyoti Paulo ordered a hamburger, and we had a hamburger, and then they continue on their walk, and then it was later in the day, later in the day, and there was a, somebody stopped to talk with them, and came from the town that they'd been in during the day. And they're talking back and forth. And they say, oh, yeah, the whole town's talking about these monks that were in town. And they say, you know, they're all wondering, I thought you were a Buddhist and you ordered a hamburger. You know? So this is, yeah, cultural expectations. But this is, you know, really way on the back of beyond in northern Minnesota. So the idea is that that expectations that are a part of being a Buddhist, or sorry, in that case a Buddhist monk, but I'm sure that lay people experience similar things where the just a sense of, yeah, so one, you know, shouldn't, either they don't or shouldn't experience or express anger, you know, as if it doesn't happen in a Buddhist, a meditator, a peaceful, quiet meditator, that somehow it doesn't happen. Or, you know, engage in you know, some kind of worldly affairs in some way. Or they're not in the military, don't have anything to do with the military. So these are assumptions that are easily made and assumed. They have an impact on us also when we're thinking of the topics and Jane Jira had some sort of experiences and or some ideas, and they're you know, people are will just sometimes just say, you know, why do you have to go to a monastery? I thought you as a practitioner, you know, the everything is teaching us. You can practice at home. So that kind of assumption or value on it and oftentimes, as Jane Jira said, oftentimes people who said that aren't practitioners. why do you have to go to India to go to the holy places? Dhamma isn't at the holy places, Dhamma is in your heart, sort of thing. What are we doing it? How do we use it? How do we hold these things that are part of the practice? How do we make it into a practice? Or what happens when we pick up a Buddhist identity? Ajahn Sujito one time saying, sometimes these people come to the monastery and it's bad enough when they're sort of so-called arahants show up at the monastery, but those, the worst ones are the bodhisattvas. Sort of picking up the sort of Buddhist identity of what they think they should be and they're fulfilling. And, you know, I'm sure everybody's sort of been given a Dhamma talk by somebody who was incredibly enthusiastic, and all you want to do is get away from them. They say, okay, Buddhist identity, where are we going with it? What are we? How are we holding it? Are we creating suffering for ourselves and others, or how are we using it? How are we assuming it? So these are, these are just some kind of ideas and things that pop into mind. But I think this is a useful theme to explore, and I think today's theme lends itself to having some. I mean, we'll have a group discussion, but I think it lends itself to small groups as well, where we can break up into small groups, and people can get together and discuss things and see where it goes. Explore these themes amongst yourselves. I'm sure you all have a variety of practice or a variety of experience that's worth reflecting on. But for the rest of this period this morning, another while, we can just open it up and see where it goes. This is a theme that I don't think it's going to have a very precise and clean and clear agenda. I think it's going to see what the group comes up with and see where it goes. So just put it out there for people to see what pops up in the pool here. Yeah, Susan.
There's a new Buddhist identity, secular Buddhist.
Ah, yes.
That I think is... Yeah. Interesting, and that people, I can't tell what that means, that they don't keep the precepts or I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
Writing about it and
being it. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's the, these are just exactly the sort of things that are good, things to be thinking, you know, what do, because certainly, I mean, I think that, say a Bhayagiri is a traditional form, a monastic form, steeped in a tradition, but, you know, there's lots of Buddhist expressions happening in America, and there's lots of Buddhist expressions in Thailand. I mean, the idea that somehow Thailand is a Buddhist country that is therefore somehow monolithic in its expression, like, forget it. but you know, I think that's a part of the reality of the human condition, that we're incredibly diverse. But then, how do we hold it, you know, in terms of one is identity, also do we react to it, trying to fit it all into one little umbrella? What are the, you know, say like that, of it's hard, you know, what does secular Buddhism, what does it even mean? It's useful.
Morning, when we were taking the refuges and precepts, you talked about those being sort of foundational aspects of being a practitioner of the Buddhist teachings. I wonder if you could talk about if that similar point, like if one calls oneself, say, a Buddhist, or even from the scriptures, I'm guessing that the Buddha didn't use the term Buddhist. In fact, I've heard that's a Western coined term. But
yeah.
If there's things that, what did the Buddha say about, okay, if you're a follower of my teachings,
right,
then that means, X, Y, and Z.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it is helpful to recognize that the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism, and the idea of Buddha, the word Buddhism is kind of arises out of the colonial British, so it's something that's been grafted on in fairly recent history. So the idea of being a Buddhist is, I think, being a follower of the Buddhist teachings is. But there is. That's why we sent out the reading for people to reflect on was that the Jivaka Sutta, which was a talk given to Jivaka Komarabhacha, who was the physician to the King Bimbisara, and the physician to the Buddha and the Sangha. So this was in Rajgaha, Rajgir. Jivaka, and he is a devotee of the a follower of the Buddha, and he asks, to what extent is one a lay follower? And then the Buddha says, yeah, going to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha for refuge is what being a lay follower is. That's where one places one's faith and one's value. Okay, those are the things that seem important to one as a lay follower, having something that one can look to as refuge. And then the Jivaka, probably knowing quite well that there's all sorts of, the Buddha had all sorts of different lay followers, and then he asked, well, what's a virtuous lay follower? Because there's probably lots of people who have faith in the Buddha, but don't really follow, don't really practice. And so that the Buddha then uses the five precepts as that basis for a virtuous lay follower, one who is has the refuges, and then really tries to maintain that standard of conduct in day-to-day life. And then Jivaka asks, to what extent is a lay follower one who practices for their own benefit but not for the benefit of others? And to what extent is one a lay follower who practices both for one's own benefit and the benefit of others? And that's a really interesting basis. Then the Buddha goes into details of practice and qualities that one can be, in terms of, one practices for one's own benefit but not for the benefit of others, so that one has conviction or faith, saddha, and doesn't encourage others in faith. And similarly, oneself is consummate in virtue and sila, in the precepts, but don't really encourage others in any overt way or even... indirect ways, so that But then the opposite is true in that sense of practicing for one's own benefit, yeah, having faith and then trying to encourage others, maintaining being consummate in virtue, and trying to encourage others, generosity, encouraging others to see the Sangha, to visit the Sangha, and to hear Dhamma, exploring that, to really try to learn the teachings, and to encourage others, to explore the meaning of the Dhamma and try to encourage others, and then to practice in accordance, in line with the Dhamma, and encourage others. So those are aspects of the being a lay follower who has a basis of faith, and then helping to encourage others in different ways. And and similarly, there has to be a balance there, because sometimes, it's just as I was saying before, somebody's encouraging others, but it's just incredibly irritating, kind of puffed up and having a sense of their own self-worth because they're a Buddhist and the other people aren't. That's a kind of kind of irritating and embarrassing. So that getting that balance. Yeah, John.
Is there a way to become involved in controversial political issues and so forth and still maintain a correctly? I got involved in the county mental health board, took a seat on it because of an issue with a family member who doesn't have to live in this county, fortunately, because their services are freestanding. And, I find myself in this sea of sometimes kind of behind the scenes, not in the meetings, allegations of misuse of funds and mm-hmm. all these millions of dollars ago, and there's nobody helping anybody, blah, blah, blah. And so, it's quite contentious, and I know mm-hmm. non-contention is a hallmark of the practice. So I did read Noah Levine's book, helped me a lot. He wrote a book called Heart of the Revolution. He talks about always coming from compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, is there a way to do these things without, if you're not a Martin Luther King yourself?
Right.
I even heard that you once protected some trees. Is that true? You got involved politically?
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah, that's
true. You were an activist.
Yeah.
Well, so that is true.
Yeah, oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
And it was, not just protecting trees, but a lot of education and not so much, exposing corruption, but not in an over... there's ways to do it that aren't contentious. There's ways to do it that aren't... that are compassionate, and I think it is important because you're looking to the benefit of many people, and you're not really doing it as a us against them and how to beat them and to denigrate them, put them down in some way, but to do things in a way that offers an opportunity for change, so that there are skillful ways of doing that. And one of the things that I found realized that Yeah, you have to be motivated. You have to keep reminding yourself to be motivated from loving kind, the Brahma Viharas. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. And that's essential. Otherwise, you end up getting burnt out. Or bitter. It's not a really good option. So to be able to approach political situations with a and that's where equanimity is really important, because some things you can resolve. I think it was last night at tea time, talking about some of the political, social aspects in Thailand, and just saying that the extent of corruption is just so deep, and you can't expect it to change just because you want it to change, and you do what you can. To try to implement skillful intention and skillful action, and see where it goes. Mm-hmm. But certainly, as a Buddhist, I don't see that as a problem. And on a certain level, I think there's a there's a lot to be said for bringing in a Buddhist and a Dhamma perspective into social justice, because you're willing to look at the longer game, look at a longer time scale. Karina.
I'm kind of curious, why do you think Chiyoka asked that last question about, is the virtuous practitioner practicing basically for themselves or for others also?
What was that?
Or for others also. Was it a question that was up during the Buddhist time?
I would think so, sure, I would think so. I mean, you look at the various exchanges that the Buddha had, and the kind of incredible fermentation in the culture and the society, questioning at that time, there's a and as part of the even then in the Buddhist time, it's sort of the you just go off in the forest and meditate, or you go live your life as a Buddhist and you don't really help anybody. And I think that's an age old question. So that as a practitioner, I think Jivaka was well aware of the criticisms that were part of the culture of the time. So I think it's probably, I would assume that it was a question or a criticism that was leveled against it. Because Buddhism was definitely a minority movement. And that was actually one of the things that when the Buddha first encourage the keeping of the lunar observance night. Then he made an allowance, which when the Buddha makes an allowance, it sort of means that's what you do. And so he said, well, keep the lunar observance night. He told the monastics, and because that was something that happened in the culture and the society of India at the time, that you'd have a religious observance day, so that the people gathered at the monastery, the monks sat there meditating through the whole night, and then word got back to the Buddha. Disgruntled lay people, the idiom that the monk just sat there like dumb pigs. So they didn't do anything. So then he made the allowance to teach. When people come for the observance night, then to teach. So that was a part of the again, that sense, okay, it's for the benefit of others as well. Yeah, Neil.
When I first read this, it wasn't quite clear whether this was intended to be a kind of a hierarchical list, like the first one is okay, the second one is better, the third one is better, and the last one is the best.
Right.
My sense is that they're all valid.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if there's meant to be some preference.
I think there is. Oftentimes that's the case. The Buddha will lay things out in of either ascending or descending order, usually ascending, so that beginning from what is foundational, and then you keep building on that. And certainly that last one of practicing Dhamma in line with the Dhamma is one of the characteristics, or one of the, not characteristics, one of the qualities that a stream enterer fulfills. Dhamma no Dhamma patibhata. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. It has another implication to it, that this is when one really fulfills that, this takes you to liberating insight.
And so that particular quality appears in both the third and the fourth grouping. So in other words, one could practice for one's own benefit and not the benefit of others and still achieve that.
It's possible, yes. Yeah. But that's there's other suttas where the Buddha speaks on this being one's own benefit and for the benefit of others, he places a higher value on being both a benefit to oneself as well as a benefit to others.
Earlier you said, this topic was partly prompted by the kind of, in part anyway, what people might say, like, why are you doing that? I thought you were a Buddhist.
Right.
So it sounds like probably if they said that because we were not living in accordance with one of the precepts,
right,
that might actually be a valid question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they saw us doing, why are you breaking that precept? I thought you were a Buddhist. We could say, well, I'm not a perfect practitioner.
Right.
And you're right.
Yeah.
I should be trying not to do that, but, I'm not there yet.
Yeah, and there is an assumption that somehow, all of these Buddhists all magically sort of transform into virtuous, peaceful beings. Which is not really the case. It's like there was one time Ajahn Chah was, I think it was when he was visiting America, and he was in an airport, and this older person was kind of looking at him and looking at him, and then he finally, he overcame his kind of shyness or curiosity, and he came up and asked Ajahn Chah. He said, are you a Buddhist? Said, yes. This is like late 1970s. Are you a Buddhist? He said, yes. Said, are you a Buddhist monk? Said, yes, yes, I'm a monk. He said, and are you from Thailand? He said, yes, yes, I'm from Thailand. He said, and in Thailand, aren't most people Buddhists? He said, yes, yes. He said, if that's the case, why are there so many thieves in Thailand? And Ajahn Chah said, well, the Buddha didn't tell them to do that. They do that themselves. So in that sense, oh yeah, here's the... yeah, here are the standards that the Buddha gives, and but yeah, people go ahead and do what they're going to do. Yeah, right.
You know, on that line, as I reflect, it's like people say, "Oh yeah, they do this," and "Oh, you find out they steal," or more, "Oh, Buddhists aren't supposed to do that." But there's something beautiful on it if you can turn it upside down. You know, for me, in saying. In some religious practices, it's like, if you're Christian, I don't hear him saying it's like you're really not supposed to steal. It's not, I mean, I think it says that, and you hear that, but not as often as sometimes being a Buddhist practitioner, how you're really supposed to get it, you know, really be in a positive way, you know, lifted above everything.
Yeah.
And so it's one hand, it's token is like, wow, it's beautiful that I have a practice that people are looking at, that my practice really looks greatly to do non-harm.
Yeah.
And yet you're forgetting that I'm human.
Yeah.
But there's something in that when you look at it that, wow, what is it from this practice that the general population or people or ourselves look at it that it, you know, placing it in this place that it really tries not to harm other people, which is actually quite wonderful.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's quite true. I mean, in generally, say, Buddhism has pretty good PR in the West. I mean, we get good press and we get looked on in a good, you know, a good positive light. And, you know, a lot of it is the newness of it. Yeah, just wait till they really see.
Unlike everything else.
Yeah. So that, but I think it can be actually used skillfully in the sense. Oh, yeah, I really want to try to. As best one can to try to fulfill that, or try to, yeah, you know, sort of like raising one's game, because one has that opportunity. There is an expectation. It can be very helpful.
Well, that isn't that essentially one of the primary benefits of, say, being monastic, is because people just sort of look at you, and then all of a sudden they don't even have to.
Yeah.
Know you, or that you say you're a Buddhist, they just look at you, and that help
kind
of requires you to maintain a certain level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's these are a great protection. So it so it does, and it's, again, it's a skillful use of a convention. You know, kind of comparing with, say, like in I mean, it's complicated, but you know, it's one aspect of, you know, say, like Catholic monasticism that I feel is unfortunate is the Catholic monks and nuns are you don't know what they are, and I think that I don't think it helps them fulfill their monastic or spiritual aspirations. I think there's been an secularizing of the within the Catholic world, which I think there's a place for having conventions that kind of, you know, define you or it's a clear signal, both to yourself, a lot of it to yourself, but also to others.
Thinking that standard, you know, that people expect of a Buddhist business, you know, becoming new to this country, and I see it as a monastic, that's probably true of anybody, but, you know, people really do hold us up, you know, in a fairly high light, in some ways have high expectations because of, you know, what we say we represent and the precepts and that kind of thing. And there's also, it seems like there's a curious phenomenon in, maybe it's not just Western culture, but that, you know, people who have a tendency to compare will also, you know, really hold you to such a high standard because in some ways they're kind of looking for, you know, looking for you to trip up. You know, and are very happy to point that out. And maybe, you know, when I was in Thailand just for a brief period of time, it seemed like maybe that didn't happen so much. Like if a monk does something that's not very beautiful, then people don't really say much. But in the West, people are quite happy to point out our mistakes. And so, you know, in some ways it's more painful and a little bit harder as something comes new to the West, whether maybe you're a monk or a Buddhist lay practitioner, but it also keeps you much more alert. If I'm representing a standard, then I really should try my best to live up to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, go on.
It seems like Buddhism in the West is, the iconic image is the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And the compassion and love that it generates. But the Theravada lineage, I think, is still very much not out there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've often wondered about is, for lack of a better term, recruiting. You know, how do you spread the word other than just to live the life and be an example? How do you spread the word so that people say, oh, you know, this is really great, maybe this is something I'd like?
Mm-hmm. I'm tired already. in the sense that I think some of the things are, say, like His Holiness just has this incredible barmy and people are drawn to him. You know, he's been doing it for so many lifetimes, I think as practitioners, there is I'm much more happy to slowly let things seep into the general pool of knowledge and see what rises to the surface, rather than trying to advertise or to scramble in the marketplace for recognition or something like that. I don't feel very comfortable with that. And you see that in a certain expressions in the contemporary culture where there is that kind of scrambling of them. I don't know. I don't think it puts deep roots down. I think of course I say especially for myself, for speaking for myself and our community, we represent a part of the spectrum of Buddhist practice, so that letting just being available is what is important. Making things available freely, publications, opportunity for anybody to stay. Those are things that I feel are really important, and that it gives an impression that is lasting in many people. Also, embodying a high standard of ethics and integrity.
Evangelical program on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I think that's what I find beautifulness in the word encourage. It doesn't mean annoy. It doesn't mean nudge.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean thou shalt turn into a pillar of salt. If you don't do that, it's like encouraging. Is like it has a positive, warm, friendly feel to it.
Yeah.
And so it's different. So it's like, to me, it's like you're encouraging, or there's an invitation. And I think for my own self, personally, it's like when we've been bringing a group up here for 12, 13 years, and I just put, email, I talk about it, in the class, and I encourage people to come. It's like, you better come, or you need to come, or if you don't come, boy, your life could be miserable. And I encourage it, and then people come, and it's just like, and then they're encouraged.
Right.
Like when they leave, and they're smiling and talking about it, and it all was just from something simple, like just a simple, oh, I'm going up here, who wants to come with me?
Right.
And when I think about that, it's like, to your question, is like, then it's like I look around the room. It's like, and then we look at a new hall being built.
Yeah.
And it just came from just simple little encouragements of sharing the Dharma. Here, let's go look at this, have a day of looking at the five precepts for the lay community. And it's like, and we all are sitting here.
Yeah.
We support a new hall.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a good perspective, because that you realize how it's those little seeds that start spreading out. we don't have enough space in the room. Yes, Maria.
Speaking of little seeds, people on the outside will sort of make fun of, like, especially the first precept when I'm, moving an ant or something like that. I was just doing that the other day, and it's sort of part of the ant underground railroad in my apartment.
I'm
putting them out, so I'm angry, so I'm doing this. And this other person made fun of me and said, well, I'm Islamic. This is how I do it. I said, no, that was even telling. So maybe down the line, she really cared about
that. No, just doing something really simple like that is a It's a good example to people that, and it's what, you know, most people, you know, aren't ever exposed to. You know, you remember the first time I stayed in a monastery, it was, I was told the precepts, but the idea of, I won't kill any mosquitoes as long as they don't come in my room. You just stay away. Once you come in here, you're fair game. Yeah.
Friday, I had a meeting and right next to our house, and as I moved, I heard. I stopped. We'd never had them before, but there was a large rattlesnake.
Ah, yeah.
And I was just about to grab the weed by him, but he warned me. So, you know, when you stand up and you think, whoa, cats, people, you know, and then, you know, it's like, wow. You know, it's like, the first wow is, wow, that's a rattlesnake. The second wow is, I'm a Buddhist. It's your lucky day, dude. But the next one is, yeah, well, what are you going to do? You don't leave the snake in the flower bed. So I arranged his... I herded him down the hill in the woods, but I posted the picture on my Facebook and warned some neighbors.
Right.
And I think there was some discomfort with the fact I didn't kill him. Is my point.
Right.
It is the traditional thing to do with pets and kids. And, although we don't, we're in the country, we don't have an immediate neighbor, we do have. So it was, there was all of this kind of boiled into one thing, you know, me, like, whoa.
Yeah.
I'm a Buddhist, it was never a possibility to destroy it, but it was interesting to see that people, my neighbors say, well, did you kill it? No.
Yeah.
So I sent them a picture and I gave them this phone number of Reptile Rescue, which come and remove rattlers free. And I also said that pets and humans need an anti-venom within 2 hours.
Yeah.
And good luck.
Yeah, I think that those are... again, yeah, in the culture, there's assumptions that that's what you do.
Yeah, Nook shares, they don't kill the huge pythons in Thailand. They relocate them now.
Yeah.
Four or five guys carrying them.
Yeah, they take them to the monasteries.
Here. Hang out with the monks.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah. We've had people like when I was living at Wat Nanachat, show up with a sack of various snakes, and Wat Nanachat was probably, you know, in terms of it's not a large forest, it'd be about 100 acres or so, no more than that, 130, 140. So it's big enough that they can, but I saw more snakes in Thailand at Wat Nanachat than I ever saw in huge jungles, real wild areas. Wat Nanachat's got a lot of snakes, but it's rare that somebody gets bitten.
I have a question about a person who claimed themselves as a person from different faith, but they kind of practiced Buddhist philosophy.
Uh-huh.
So pretty much they follow the five precepts. They meditate. But they have their own faith and belief as well.
Mm-hmm.
Should they call themselves a kind of Buddhist? Or should they call themselves whatever religion that they practice? I mean, for me, I kind of think that being a Buddhist, anybody from any faith can adopt a Buddhist lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
and live a Buddhist life,
mm-hmm.
without claiming self as a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's the, you know, again, that's what I was saying before. I didn't sort of fill it out very much, because, like, the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. He taught Dhamma, he taught truth, he taught a path leading out of suffering, so that the Buddha wasn't really trying to get as many sort of card-carrying Buddhists in the world as he could get. He was trying to encourage human beings to suffer less and be more happy and be better human beings. So that, the label is kind of irrelevant to a certain degree. I think that the Buddha's teachings are applicable for anybody, really. The more people see that they're what the roots are, then maybe the more serious interest they'll show in it, which is useful. It's good.
I've seen some Buddhists that get really upset when they hear that someone say that Buddhism is a philosophy. They get like,
yeah. Yeah, well, that, I mean, yeah, because it's a lot more than that. Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot more than that. Yeah, Karina.
At the beginning, you mentioned cultural views and expectations, how they can be skillful also, and something we can try to live up to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, I'm just sort of thinking in terms of knowing that you're identified as a Buddhist, and a Buddhist is supposed to take non-harming as a foundation. So you have to exercise restraint killing all the things that you don't like or getting rid of them, and so that's a helpful tool for actually trying to keep in a circumstance that's either confusing or upsetting. Okay, how do I hold an anchor? Both as a way of helping myself, but then also, okay, that's I've got this practice. How do I apply it? How do I live it? How do I use it so that it's again this benefit for oneself and benefit for others? Because so often in a group. Maybe an example of where there's a group of people together, and people are just, it's so easy to get into conversations of criticizing, fault finding, expressing anger at something, and it's realizing, no, I don't want to engage in that, and. And that's the whole essence of the fourth precept. I mean, it's not just uttering false speech, but it's also gossip, backbiting, harsh speech. So those are so that we say, I can use that to try to, rather than, because sometimes it is kind of satisfying to sit around and criticize something. You know, there's a perverse kind of attraction to that. But using and saying, no, it's really not what the teachings encourage. And so, okay, I'll up my game a bit and I'll get involved. I'm not gonna participate. You know, and sometimes that one, you start protecting yourself, but two, it can be something that helps to generate a conversation. You know, why aren't you? It can help to settle something that is spinning into a lot of negativity. It can help to diffuse that. So you know, there's ways that one can use that internal identification as a means of supporting one's own aspiration.
Let me ask.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious about this situation that, and I love that idea of Buddhist perspective infusing a situation, whether it's social change. hypothetically, let's say there's you know, of abuse going on.
Hmm?
You know, abuse happening.
Mm-hmm.
And both the abuser and the abused are just kind of stuck. They don't see that they can change anything. How to hold that situation, where it's similar to, you know, how do you encourage others, or how do you spread? Maybe not spread, but how do you encourage others to follow this path?
I don't know. I mean, it's a bit too general. Because one, just in the sense of overtly holding out a possibility of not suffering or not harming, I'm saying, you know, that is a possibility, and for many people that's it's hardly conceivable. So that to actually express that, or to say that, or to embody that, and say that okay, that's something different, something that many people don't have the opportunity to come into contact with, so that's incredible benefit, because those possibilities, it's like you plant seeds for a possibility, and you can't make the seeds grow, but you can plant the seeds. Yes, Alex.
So, you know, a lot of the path is not identification.
Mm-hmm.
What is the right point to drop or to sort of ignore that, like, desire to identify with the Buddhist identity?
Well, I think one of the things is you always have to pay attention to suffering. That's the aspect of because we can use identity skillfully, just say in the way that I was just talking about. You know, we can use that skillfully, and it's not. I think it's helpful for people to sort of say, oh, yeah, there is a way of being that's actually associated with something. It's not some nebulous thing out in the cosmos somewhere. You know, this is actually real. So that's something that can be very helpful and fruitful and beneficial. So it's around the sense of suffering. But then if either we can hold ourselves to such an ideal that we just make ourselves miserable and completely unrealistic, which we're, especially in America, people are great at. Or we can just hold to an identity that just a pain in the butt wherever you go. So we're tuning into suffering, and that sense of suffering, dissonance, discontent, dis-ease, and it's okay. We have to have our antenna out, sort of see what am I feeling and what's happening around me, if we're using, because we have to model somehow. We're using models all the time anyway. Do we take a Buddhist model, from wherever we get it, or do we take some kind of model of how a human being is from some television show, which may or may not be a decent model of good human beings. But is a sense of, because people are picking up. That's what we pick up. We're absorbing this all the time. Cultural models, cultural emulating. So that becoming more conscious of how we're using it and what we're relying on for our modeling. So then we can. So we're using identity in a conscious, skillful way as best we can.
It sort of seems like, and then using it, as just you're saying, using it for a purpose, and then also realizing that it's not something to grasp onto.
Yeah, yeah.
Forever identity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think of one of the things that comes to mind is Ajahn Chah saying, in terms of say Buddhist identity. I mean, was he the warm, wise grandfather? Was he the ferocious taskmaster? Was he the engaging storyteller? Was he the irritating disciplinarian? He was all of those, and more. And those are identities you'd pick up, but you'd also see him just drop them. He wouldn't carry it around. So those are aspects of our human expression that we learn how to rely on, and that's where that recognize, how do we decide what are we using as a standard. And so that the Buddha is always pointing to what is it that increases happiness and well-being and decreases suffering? What is it that increases wholesome qualities and decreases the unwholesome qualities? Those are the things that we want to how we direct our attention. In order to develop and utilize the practice and utilize the tools of being a Buddhist.
Kind of a twist on Buddhist identity that came up once for me talking with somebody a couple of years ago, and that she was talking about how she really likes a lot of the Buddhist teachings and the Buddhist principles and follows the precepts and practices meditation, but she just hates when people identify with anything like this and call themselves Buddhist, and that she was very clear that she wasn't a Buddhist, and she doesn't get into labels or roles or anything like this, and made kind of very strong
ongoing point about, you know, yeah, this is okay stuff, but I'm not a Buddhist. Somebody asked me, I don't, you know, I don't have to be anything. I don't pick up an identity for anything. You know, it's just useless trying to pin yourself into a, you know, a role or anything like that. And I just said to myself, it seems like, you know, you have a pretty strong tendency to form a very strong identity around not being anything. And she sort of went, oh, wow, you're right.
I'm not anything.
I'm not anything.
She said, non-Buddhist.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's like little Porter, you were just saying, like the wholesome and the unwholesome. And
yeah.
That's what I keep coming back to, is true principle. Yeah. Like, what are we doing it all for?
Yeah.
And like the not killing is like the principle of not harming. So you actually learn to get a feel for it rather than just like not killing just because somebody said to not kill. But like,
yeah,
like there were these, I have a wasp nest in my outdoor light in my kuti, and there's these paper wasps that live in there. So I forgot about them one night and I turned on my outdoor light and my outdoor light was on. And I was sitting on my porch and the outdoor light gets hot and they started buzzing and getting agitated. And I thought, I don't want them to be uncomfortable, so I just turn the light off. But that, I wasn't breaking any precepts by having the light on. And, you know, I could have easily thought, oh, if I leave the light on, I'll scorch them and they'll go away or something. I wouldn't have broken any precepts. But then a couple of days later, they left. Actually, the big nest was just empty. Just took it out. So, like, principle.
Yeah, I think that's really important in that sense of the all of the different practices or standards that so-called define what is a Buddhist or whatever. Yeah, they aren't just rules to conform to or standards to conform to, but they have a purpose. And that purpose is that, you know, decreasing suffering, increasing happiness, decreasing the unwholesome, increasing the wholesome, increasing peace, decreasing confusion. And that's the underlying principle that we want to be plugging into. Yeah. And that's what can help us decide how do we maintain this? Why are we doing this? You know, it isn't just to fulfill the label, but yeah, to be able to plug into and embody these principles, these qualities.